Silent Spring, Disc 3.
Besides the more than 4 million acres of rangeland sprayed each year, tremendous areas of other types of land are also potential or actual recipients of chemical treatments for weed control. For example, an area larger than all of New England, some 50 million acres, is under management by utility corporations, and much of it is routinely treated for brush control. In the Southwest, an estimated 75 million acres of mesquite lands require management by some means, and chemical spraying is the method most actively pushed. An unknown but very large acreage of timber-producing lands is now aerially sprayed in order to weed out the hardwoods from the more spray-resistant conifers. Treatment of agricultural lands with herbicides doubled in the decade following 1949, totaling 53 million acres in 1959. And the combined acreage of private lawns, parks, and golf courses now being treated must reach an astronomical figure. The chemical weed killers are a bright new toy. They work in a spectacular way. They give a giddy sense of power over nature to those who wield them. And as for the long-range and less obvious effects, these are easily brushed aside as the baseless imaginings of pessimists. The agricultural engineers speak blithely of chemical plowing in a world that is urged to beat its plowshares into spray guns. The town fathers of 1,000 communities lend willing ears to the chemical salesmen and the eager contractors who will rid the roadside of brush for a price. It is cheaper than mowing, is the cry. So perhaps it appears in the neat rows of figures in the official books. But were the true costs entered, the costs not only in dollars, but in the many equally valid debits we shall presently consider, the wholesale broadcasting of chemicals would be seen to be more costly in dollars as well as infinitely damaging to the long-range health of the landscape and to all the varied interests that depend on it. Take, for instance, that commodity prized by every chamber of commerce throughout the land, the goodwill of vacationing tourists. There is a steadily growing chorus of outraged protest about the disfigurement of the once beautiful roadsides by chemical sprays, which substitute a sere expanse of brown, withered vegetation for the beauty of fern and wildflower, of native shrubs adorned with blossom or berry. We are making a dirty, brown, dying-looking mess along the sides of our roads, a New England woman wrote angrily to her newspaper. This is not what the tourists expect, with all the money we are spending advertising the beautiful scenery. In the summer of 1960, conservationists from many states converged on a peaceful Maine island to witness its presentation to the National Audubon Society by its owner, Millicent Todd Bingham. The focus that day was on the preservation of the natural landscape and of the intricate web of life whose interwoven strands lead from microbes to man. But in the background of all the conversations among the visitors to the island was indignation at the despoiling of the roads they had traveled. Once it had been a joy to follow those roads through the evergreen forests, roads lined with bayberry and sweet fern, alder and huckleberry. Now, all was brown desolation. One of the conservationists wrote of that August pilgrimage to a Maine island, "I returned angry at the desecration of the Maine roadsides, where in previous years the highways were bordered with wildflowers and attractive shrubs. There were only the scars of dead vegetation for mile after mile. As an economic proposition, can Maine afford the loss of tourist goodwill that such sites induce?" Maine roadsides are merely one example of the senseless destruction that is going on in the name of roadside brush control throughout the nation, though a particularly sad one for those of us who have a deep love for the beauty of that state. Botanists at the Connecticut Arboretum declare that the elimination of beautiful native shrubs and wildflowers has reached the proportions of a roadside crisis. Azaleas, mountain laurel, blueberries, huckleberries, viburnums, dogwood, bayberry, sweet fern, low shad bush, winterberry, choke cherry, and wild plum are dying before the chemical barrage. So are the daisies, black-eyed Susans, Queen Anne's lace, goldenrods, and fall asters, which lend grace and beauty to the landscape. The spraying is not only improperly planned, but studded with abuses such as these. In a southern New England town, one contractor finished his work with some chemical remaining in his tank. He discharged this along woodland roadsides where no spraying had been authorized. As a result, the community lost the blue and golden beauty of its autumn roads, where asters and goldenrod would have made a display worth traveling far to see. In another New England community, a contractor changed the state specifications for town spraying without the knowledge of the highway department and sprayed roadside vegetation to a height of 8 feet instead of the specified maximum of 4 feet, leaving a broad, disfiguring brown swath. In a Massachusetts community, the town officials purchased a weed killer from a zealous chemical salesman, unaware that it contained arsenic. One result of the subsequent roadside spraying was the death of a dozen cows from arsenic poisoning. Trees within the Connecticut Arboretum Natural Area were seriously injured when the town of Waterford sprayed the roadsides with chemical weed killers in 1957. Even large trees not directly sprayed were affected. The leaves of the oaks began to curl and turn brown, although it was the season for spring growth. Then new shoots began to be put forth and grew with abnormal rapidity, giving a weeping appearance to the trees. 2 seasons later, large branches on these trees had died. Others were without leaves, and the deformed, weeping effect of whole trees persisted. I know well a stretch of road where nature's own landscaping has provided a border of alder, viburnum, sweet fern, and juniper, with seasonally changing accents of bright flowers or of fruits hanging in jeweled clusters in the fall. The road had no heavy load of traffic to support. There were few sharp curves or intersections where brush could obstruct the driver's vision. But the sprayers took over, and the miles along that road became something to be traversed quickly, a sight to be endured with one's mind closed to thoughts of the sterile and hideous world we are letting our technicians make. But here and there, authority had somehow faltered, and by an unaccountable oversight, there were oases of beauty in the midst of austere and regimented control. Oases that made the desecration of the greater part of the road the more unbearable. In such places, my spirit lifted to the sight of the drifts of white clover or the clouds of purple vetch, with here and there the flaming cup of a wood lily. Such plants are weeds, only to those who make a business of selling and applying chemicals. In a volume of proceedings of one of the weed control conferences that are now regular institutions, I once read an extraordinary statement of a weed killer's philosophy. The author defended the killing of good plants simply because they are in bad company. Those who complain about killing wildflowers along roadsides reminded him, he said, of anti-vivisectionists, to whom, if one were to judge by their actions, the life of a stray dog is more sacred than the lives of children. To the author of this paper, many of us would unquestionably be suspect, convicted of some deep perversion of character because we prefer the sight of the vetch and the clover and the woodlily in all their delicate and transient beauty, to that of roadsides scorched as by fire, the shrubs brown and brittle, the bracken that once lifted high its proud lacework, now withered and drooping. We would seem deplorably weak that we can tolerate the sight of such weeds, that we do not rejoice in their eradication, that we are not filled with exultation that man has once more triumphed over miscreant nature. Justice Douglas tells of attending a meeting of federal field men who were discussing protests by citizens against plans for the spraying of sagebrush that I mentioned earlier. These men considered it hilariously funny that an old lady had opposed the plan because the wildflowers would be destroyed. Yet was not her right to search out a banded cup or a tiger lily as inalienable as the right of stockmen to search out grass or of a lumberman to claim a tree, asks this humane and perceptive jurist. The aesthetic values of the wilderness are as much our inheritance as the veins of copper and gold in our hills and the forests in our mountains. There is, of course, more to the wish to preserve our roadside vegetation than even such aesthetic considerations. In the economy of nature, the natural vegetation has its essential place. Hedgerows along country roads and bordering fields provide food, cover, and nesting area for birds, and homes for many small animals. Of some 70 species of shrubs and vines that are typical roadside species in the eastern states alone, about 65 are important to wildlife as food. Such vegetation is also the habitat of wild bees and other pollinating insects. Man is more dependent on these wild pollinators than he usually realizes. Even the farmer himself seldom understands the value of wild bees and often participates in the very measures that rob him of their services. Some agricultural crops and many wild plants are partly or wholly dependent on the services of the native pollinating insects. Several hundred species of wild bees take part in the pollination of cultivated crops, 100 species visiting the flowers of alfalfa alone. Without insect pollination, most of the soil-holding and soil-enriching plants of uncultivated areas would die out, with far-reaching consequences to the ecology of the whole region. Many herbs, shrubs, and trees of forest and range depend on native insects for their reproduction. Without these plants, many wild animals and range stock would find little food. Now, clean cultivation and the chemical destruction of hedgerows and weeds are eliminating the last sanctuaries of these pollinating insects and breaking the threads that bind life to life. These insects, so essential to our agriculture and indeed to our landscape as we know it, deserve something better from us than the senseless destruction of their habitat. Honeybees and wild bees depend heavily on such weeds as goldenrod, mustard, and dandelions for pollen that serves as the food of their young. Vetch furnishes essential spring forage for bees before the alfalfa is in bloom, tiding them over this early season so that they are ready to pollinate the alfalfa. In the fall, they depend on goldenrod at a season when no other food is available to stock up for the winter. By the precise and delicate timing that is nature's own, the emergence of one species of wild bees takes place on the very day of the opening of the willow blossoms. There is no dearth of men who understand these things. But these are not the men who order the wholesale drenching of the landscape with chemicals. And where are the men who supposedly understand the value of proper habitat for the preservation of wildlife? Too many of them are to be found defending herbicides as harmless to wildlife because they are thought to be less toxic than insecticides. Therefore, it is said, no harm is done. But as the herbicides rain down on forest and field, on marsh and rangeland, they are bringing about marked changes and even permanent destruction of wildlife habitat. To destroy the homes and the food of wildlife is perhaps worse in the long run than direct killing. The irony of this all-out chemical assault on roadsides and utility rights of way is twofold. It is perpetuating the problem it seeks to correct. For as experience has clearly shown, the blanket application of herbicides does not permanently control roadside brush, and the spraying has to be repeated year after year. And as a further irony, we persist in doing this despite the fact that a perfectly sound method of selective spraying is known. which can achieve long-term vegetational control and eliminate repeated spraying in most types of vegetation. The object of brush control along roads and rights-of-way is not to sweep the land clear of everything but grass. It is rather to eliminate plants ultimately tall enough to present an obstruction to drivers' vision or interference with wires on rights-of-way. This means, in general, trees. Most shrubs are low enough to present no hazard. So certainly are ferns and wildflowers. Selective spraying was developed by Dr. Frank Egler during a period of years at the American Museum of Natural History as director of a committee for brush control recommendations for rights of way. It took advantage of the inherent stability of nature, building on the fact that most communities of shrubs are strongly resistant to invasion by trees. By comparison, grasslands are easily invaded by tree seedlings. The object of selective spraying is not to produce grass on roadsides and rights of way, but to eliminate the tall woody plants by direct treatment and to preserve all other vegetation. One treatment may be sufficient, with a possible follow-up for extremely resistant species. Thereafter, the shrubs assert control and the trees do not return. The best and cheapest controls for vegetation are not chemicals, but other plants. The method has been tested in research areas scattered throughout the eastern United States. Results show that once properly treated, an area becomes stabilized, requiring no respraying for at least 20 years. The spraying can often be done by men on foot, using knapsack sprayers, and having complete control over their material. Sometimes compressor pumps and material can be mounted on truck chassis, but there is no blanket spraying. Treatment is directed only to trees and any exceptionally tall shrubs that must be eliminated. The integrity of the environment is thereby preserved, the enormous value of the wildlife habitat remains intact, and the beauty of shrub and fern and wildflower has not been sacrificed. Here and there, the method of vegetation management by selective spraying has been adopted. For the most part, entrenched custom dies hard, and blanket spraying continues to thrive, to exact its heavy annual costs from the taxpayer and to inflict its damage on the ecological web of life. It thrives, surely, only because the facts are not known. When taxpayers understand that the bill for spraying the town roads should come due only once a generation instead of once a year, they will surely rise up and demand a change of method. Among the many advantages of selective spraying is the fact that it minimizes the amount of chemical applied to the landscape. There is no broadcasting of material, but rather concentrated application to the base of trees. The potential harm to wildlife is therefore kept to a minimum. The most widely used herbicides are 2,4-D, 2,4-5-T, and related compounds. Whether or not these are actually toxic is a matter of controversy. People spraying their lawns with 2,4-D and becoming wet with spray have occasionally developed severe neuritis and even paralysis. Although such incidents are apparently uncommon, medical authorities advise caution in use of such compounds. Other hazards, more obscure, may also attend the use of 2,4-D. It has been shown experimentally to disturb the basic physiological process of respiration in the cell and to imitate X-rays in damaging the chromosomes. Some very recent work indicates that reproduction of birds may be adversely affected by these and certain other herbicides at levels far below those that cause death. Apart from any direct toxic effects, curious indirect results follow the use of certain herbicides. It has been found that animals, both wild herbivores and livestock, are sometimes strangely attracted to a plant that has been sprayed, even though it is not one of their natural foods. If a highly poisonous herbicide such as arsenic has been used, this intense desire to reach the wilting vegetation inevitably has disastrous results. fatal results may follow also from less toxic herbicides if the plant itself happens to be poisonous, or perhaps to possess thorns or burrs. Poisonous range weeds, for example, have suddenly become attractive to livestock after spraying, and the animals have died from indulging this unnatural appetite. The literature of veterinary medicine abounds in similar examples. Swine eating sprayed cockleburrs with consequent severe illness, lambs eating sprayed thistles, bees poisoned by pasturing on mustard sprayed after it came into bloom. Wild cherry, the leaves of which are highly poisonous, has exerted a fatal attraction for cattle once its foliage has been sprayed with 2,4-D. Apparently, the wilting that follows spraying or cutting makes the plant attractive. Ragwort has provided other examples. Livestock ordinarily avoid this plant unless forced to turn to it in late winter and early spring by lack of other forage. However, the animals eagerly feed on it after its foliage has been sprayed with 2,4-D. The explanation of this peculiar behavior sometimes appears to lie in the changes which the chemical brings about in the metabolism of the plant itself. There is temporarily a marked increase in sugar content, making the plant more attractive to many animals. Another curious effect of 2,4-D has important effects for livestock, wildlife, and apparently for men as well. Experiments carried out about a decade ago showed that after treatment with this chemical, there is a sharp increase in the nitrate content of corn and of sugar beets. The same effect was suspected in sorghum, sunflower, spiderwort, lamb's quarters, pigweed, and smartweed. Some of these are normally ignored by cattle, but are eaten with relish after treatment with 2,4-D. A number of deaths among cattle have been traced to sprayed weeds, according to some agricultural specialists. The danger lies in the increase in nitrates. For the peculiar physiology of the ruminant at once poses a critical problem. Most such animals have a digestive system of extraordinary complexity, including a stomach divided into four chambers. The digestion of cellulose is accomplished through the action of microorganisms, rumen bacteria, in one of the chambers. When the animal feeds on vegetation containing an abnormally high level of nitrates, the microorganisms in the rumen act on the nitrates to change them into highly toxic nitrites. Thereafter, a fatal chain of events ensues. The nitrites act on the blood pigment to form a chocolate-brown substance in which the oxygen is so firmly held that it cannot take part in respiration. Hence, oxygen is not transferred from the lungs to the tissues. Death occurs within a few hours from anoxia, or lack of oxygen. The various reports of livestock losses after grazing on certain weeds treated with 2,4-D therefore have a logical explanation. The same danger exists for wild animals belonging to the group of ruminants, such as deer, antelope, sheep, and goats. Although various factors, such as exceptionally dry weather, can cause an increase in nitrate content, the effect of the soaring sales and applications of 2,4-D cannot be ignored. The situation was considered important enough by the University of Wisconsin Agricultural Experiment Station to justify a warning in 1957 that plants killed by 2,4-D may contain large amounts of nitrate. The hazard extends to human beings as well as animals and may help to explain the recent mysterious increase in silo deaths. When corn, oats, or sorghum containing large amounts of nitrates are ensiled, they release poisonous nitrogen oxide gases, creating a deadly hazard to anyone entering the silo. Only a few breaths of one of these gases can cause a diffuse chemical pneumonia. In a series of such cases studied by the University of Minnesota Medical School, all but one terminated fatally. Once again, we are walking in nature like an elephant in the china cabinet. So C.J. Breer, a Dutch scientist of rare understanding, sums up our use of weed killers. In my opinion, too much is taken for granted. We do not know whether all weeds and crops are harmful or whether some of them are useful, says Dr. Breer. Seldom is the question asked, what is the relation between the weed and the soil? Perhaps even from our narrow standpoint of direct self-interest, the relation is a useful one. As we have seen, soil and the living things in and upon it exist in a relation of interdependence and mutual benefit. Presumably the weed is taking something from the soil. Perhaps it is also contributing something to it. A practical example was provided recently by the parks in a city in Holland. The roses were doing badly. Soil samples showed heavy infestations by tiny nematode worms. Scientists of the Dutch Plant Protection Service did not recommend chemical sprays or soil treatments. Instead, they suggested that marigolds be planted among the roses. This plant, which the purist would doubtless consider a weed in any rose bed, releases an excretion from its roots that kills the soil nematodes. The advice was taken. Some beds were planted with marigolds, some left without as controls. The results were striking. With the aid of the marigolds, the roses flourished. In the control beds, they were sickly and drooping. Marigolds are now used in many places for combating nematodes. In the same way, and perhaps quite unknown to us, other plants that we ruthlessly eradicate may be performing a function that is necessary to the health of the soil. One very useful function of natural plant communities, now pretty generally stigmatized as weeds, is to serve as an indicator of the condition of the soil. This useful function is, of course, lost where chemical weed killers have been used. Those who find an answer to all problems in spraying also overlook a matter of great scientific importance, the need to preserve some natural plant communities. We need these as standards against which we can measure the changes our own activities bring about. We need them as wild habitats in which original populations of insects and other organisms can be maintained, for, as will be explained in Chapter 16, the development of resistance to insecticides is changing the genetic factors of insects and perhaps other organisms. One scientist has even suggested that some sort of zoo should be established to preserve insects, mites, and the like before their genetic composition is further changed. Some experts warn of subtle but far-reaching vegetational shifts as a result of the growing use of herbicides. The chemical 2,4-D, by killing out the broad-leafed plants, allows the grasses to thrive in the reduced competition. Now, some of the grasses themselves have become weeds, presenting a new problem in control and giving the cycle another turn. This strange situation is acknowledged in a recent issue of a journal devoted to crop problems. With the widespread use of 2,4-D to control broad-leafed weeds, grass weeds in particular have increasingly become a threat to corn and soybean yields. Ragweed, the bane of hay fever sufferers, offers an interesting example of the way efforts to control nature sometimes boomerang. Many thousands of gallons of chemicals have been discharged along roadsides in the name of ragweed control. But the unfortunate truth is that blanket spraying is resulting in more ragweed, not less. Ragweed is an annual. Its seedlings require open soil to become established each year. Our best protection against this plant is therefore the maintenance of dense shrubs, ferns, and other perennial vegetation. Spraying frequently destroys this protective vegetation and creates open, barren areas, which the ragweed hastens to fill. It is probable, moreover, that the pollen content of the atmosphere is not related to roadside ragweed, but to the ragweed of city lots and fallow fields. The booming sales of chemical crabgrass killers are another example of how readily unsound methods catch on. There is a cheaper and better way to remove crabgrass than to attempt year after year to kill it out with chemicals. This is to give it competition of a kind it cannot survive, the competition of other grass. Crabgrass exists only in an unhealthy lawn. It is a symptom, not a disease in itself. By providing a fertile soil and giving the desired grasses a good start, it is possible to create an environment in which crabgrass cannot grow, for it requires open space in which it can start from seed year after year. Instead of treating the basic condition, suburbanites advised by nurserymen, who in turn have been advised by the chemical manufacturers, continue to apply truly astonishing amounts of crabgrass killers to their lawns each year. Marketed under trade names which give no hint of their nature, many of these preparations contain such poisons as mercury, arsenic, and chlordane. Application at the recommended rates leaves tremendous amounts of these chemicals on the lawn. Users of one product, for example, apply 60 pounds of technical chlordane to the acre if they follow directions. If they use another of the many available products, they are applying 175 pounds of metallic arsenic to the acre. The toll of dead birds, as we shall see in Chapter 8, is distressing. How lethal these lawns may be for human beings is unknown. The success of selective spraying for roadside and right-of-way vegetation, where it has been practiced, offers hope that equally sound ecological methods may be developed for other vegetation programs, for farms, forests, and ranges, methods aimed not at destroying a particular species, but at managing vegetation as a living community. Other solid achievements show what can be done. Biological control has achieved some of its most spectacular successes in the area of curbing unwanted vegetation. Nature herself has met many of the problems that now beset us, and she has usually solved them in her own successful way. Where man has been intelligent enough to observe and to emulate nature, he too is often rewarded with success. An outstanding example in the field of controlling unwanted plants is the handling of the klamath weed problem in California. Although the klamath weed, or goatweed, is a native of Europe, where it is called St. John's wort, it accompanied man in his westward migrations, first appearing in the United States in 1793 near Lancaster, Pennsylvania. By 1900, it had reached California in the vicinity of the Klamath River, hence the name locally given to it. By 1929, it had occupied about 100,000 acres of rangeland, and by 1952, it had invaded some 2.5 million acres. Klamath weed, quite unlike such native plants as sagebrush, has no place in the ecology of the region, and no animals or other plants require its presence. On the contrary, wherever it appeared, livestock became scabby, sore-mouthed, and unthrifty from feeding on this toxic plant. Land values declined accordingly, for the klamath weed was considered to hold the first mortgage. In Europe, the klamath weed, or St. John's wort, has never become a problem because along with the plant, there have developed various species of insects. These feed on it so extensively that its abundance is severely limited. In particular, two species of beetles in southern France, pea-sized and of metallic color, have their whole being so adapted to the presence of the weed that they feed and reproduce only upon it. It was an event of historic importance when the first shipment of these beetles were brought to the United States in 1944, for this was the first attempt in North America to control a plant with a plant-eating insect. By 1948, both species had become so well established that no further importations were needed. Their spread was accomplished by collecting beetles from the original colonies and redistributing them at the rate of millions a year. Within small areas, the beetles accomplish their own dispersion, moving on as soon as the klamath weed dies out and locating new stands with great precision. And as the beetles thin out the weed, desirable range plants that have been crowded out are able to return. A 10-year survey completed in 1959 showed that control of the klamath weed had been more effective than hoped for, even by enthusiasts, with the weed reduced to a mere 1% of its former abundance. This token infestation is harmless and is actually needed in order to maintain a population of beetles as protection against a future increase in the weed. Another extraordinarily successful and economical example of weed control may be found in Australia. With the colonists' usual taste for carrying plants or animals into a new country, a Captain Arthur Phillip had brought various species of cactus into Australia in 1787, intending to use them in culturing cochineal insects for dye. Some of the cacti, or prickly pears, escaped from his gardens, and by 1925, about 20 species could be found growing wild. Having no natural controls in this new territory, they spread prodigiously, eventually occupying about 60 million acres. At least half of this land was so densely covered as to be useless. In 1920, Australian entomologists were sent to North and South America to study insect enemies of the prickly pears in their native habitat. After trials of several species, 3 billion eggs of an Argentine moth were released in Australia in 1930. 7 years later, the last dense growth of prickly pear had been destroyed, and the once uninhabitable areas reopened to settlement and grazing. The whole operation had cost less than a penny per acre. In contrast, the unsatisfactory attempts at chemical control in earlier years had cost about £10 per acre. Both of these examples suggest that extremely effective control of many kinds of unwanted vegetation might be achieved by paying more attention to the role of plant-eating insects. The science of range management has largely ignored this possibility, although these insects are perhaps the most selective of all grazers, and their highly restricted diets could easily be turned to man's advantage. Chapter 7. Needless Havoc. As man proceeds towards his announced goal of the conquest of nature, he has written a depressing record of destruction, directed not only against the earth he inhabits, but against the life that shares it with him. The history of the recent centuries has its black passages: the slaughter of the buffalo on the western plains, the massacre of the shorebirds by the market gunners, the near extermination of the egrets for their plumage. Now to these and others like them, we are adding a new chapter and a new kind of havoc: the direct killing of birds, mammals, fishes, and indeed practically every form of wildlife by chemical insecticides indiscriminately sprayed on the land. Under the philosophy that now seems to guide our destinies, nothing must get in the way of the man with the spray gun. The incidental victims of his crusade against insects count as nothing. If robins, pheasants, raccoons, cats, or even livestock happen to inhabit the same bit of earth as the target insects and to be hit by the rain of insect-killing poisons, no one must protest. The citizen who wishes to make a fair judgment of the question of wildlife loss is today confronted with a dilemma. On the one hand, conservationists and many wildlife biologists assert that the losses have been severe and in some cases even catastrophic. On the other hand, the control agencies tend to deny flatly and categorically that such losses have occurred, or that they are of any importance if they have. Which view are we to accept? The credibility of the witness is of first importance. The professional wildlife biologist on the scene is certainly best qualified to discover and interpret wildlife loss. The entomologist, whose specialty is insects, is not so qualified by training and is not psychologically disposed to look for undesirable side effects of his control program. Yet it is the control men in state and federal governments, and of course the chemical manufacturers, who steadfastly deny the facts reported by the biologists and declare that they see little evidence of harm to wildlife. Like the priest and the Levite in the biblical story, they choose to pass by on the other side and see nothing. Even if we charitably explain their denials as due to the short-sightedness of the specialist and the man with an interest, this does not mean we must accept them as qualified witnesses. The best way to form our own judgment is to look at some of the major control programs and learn from observers familiar with the ways of wildlife and unbiased in favor of chemicals just what has happened in the wake of a rain of poison falling from the skies into the world of wildlife. To the bird watcher, the suburbanite who derives joy from birds in his garden, the hunter, the fisherman, or the explorer of wild regions, anything that destroys the wildlife of an area for even a single year has deprived him of pleasure to which he has a legitimate right. This is a valid point of view. Even if, as has sometimes happened, some of the birds and mammals and fishes are able to reestablish themselves after a single spraying, a great and real harm has been done. But such reestablishment is unlikely to happen. Spraying tends to be repetitive, and a single exposure from which the wildlife populations might have a chance to recover is a rarity. What usually results is a poisoned environment, a lethal trap in which not only the resident populations succumb, but those who come in as migrants as well. The larger the area sprayed, the more serious the harm, because no oases of safety remain. Now in a decade marked by insect control programs, in which many thousands or even millions of acres are sprayed as a unit, a decade in which private and community spraying has also surged steadily upward, a record of destruction and death of American wildlife has accumulated. Let us look at some of these programs and see what has happened. During the fall of 1959, some 27,000 acres in southeastern Michigan, including numerous suburbs of Detroit, were heavily dusted from the air with pellets of aldrin, one of the most dangerous of all the chlorinated hydrocarbons. The program was conducted by the Michigan Department of Agriculture with the cooperation of the United States Department of Agriculture. Its announced purpose was control of the Japanese beetle. Little need was shown for this drastic and dangerous action. On the contrary, Walter P. Nickel, one of the best-known and best-informed naturalists in the state, who spends much of his time in the field with long periods in southern Michigan every summer, declared, "For more than 30 years, to my direct knowledge, the Japanese beetle has been present in the city of Detroit in small numbers. The numbers have not shown any appreciable increase in all this lapse of years. I have yet to see a single Japanese beetle in 1959, other than the few caught in government catch traps in Detroit. Everything is being kept so secret that I have not yet been able to obtain any information whatsoever to the effect that they have increased in numbers." An official release by the state agency merely declared that the beetle had put in its appearance in the areas designated for the aerial attack upon it. Despite the lack of justification, the program was launched, with the state providing the manpower and supervising the operation, the federal government providing equipment and additional men, and the communities paying for the insecticide. The Japanese beetle, an insect accidentally imported into the United States, was discovered in New Jersey in 1916, when a few shiny beetles of a metallic green color were seen in a nursery near Riverton. The beetles, at first unrecognized, were finally identified as a common inhabitant of the main islands of Japan. Apparently, they had entered the United States on nursery stock imported before restrictions were established in 1912. From its original point of entrance, the Japanese beetle has spread rather widely throughout many of the states east of the Mississippi, where conditions of temperature and rainfall are suitable for it. Each year, some outward movement beyond the existing boundaries of its distribution usually takes place. In the eastern areas, where the beetles have been longest established, attempts have been made to set up natural controls. Where this has been done, the beetle populations have been kept at relatively low levels, as many records attest. Despite the record of reasonable control in eastern areas, the Midwestern states, now on the fringe of the beetle's range, have launched an attack worthy of the most deadly enemy instead of only a moderately destructive insect. employing the most dangerous chemicals, distributed in a manner that exposes large numbers of people, their domestic animals, and all wildlife to the poison intended for the beetle. As a result, these Japanese beetle programs have caused shocking destruction of animal life and have exposed human beings to undeniable hazard. Sections of Michigan, Kentucky, Iowa, Indiana, Illinois, and Missouri are all experiencing a rain of chemicals in the name of beetle control. The Michigan spraying was one of the first large-scale attacks on the Japanese beetle from the air. The choice of aldrin, one of the deadliest of all chemicals, was not determined by any peculiar suitability for Japanese beetle control, but simply by the wish to save money. Aldrin was the cheapest of the compounds available. While the state in its official release to the press acknowledged that aldrin is a poison, it implied that no harm could come to human beings in the heavily populated areas to which the chemical was applied. The official answer to the query, "What precautions should I take?" was, "For you, none." An official of the Federal Aviation Agency was later quoted in the local press to the effect that this is a safe operation. And a representative of the Detroit Department of Parks and Recreation added his assurance that the dust is harmless to humans and will not hurt plants or pets. One must assume that none of these officials had consulted the published and readily available reports of the United States Public Health Service, the Fish and Wildlife Service, and other evidence of the extremely poisonous nature of aldrin. Acting under the Michigan Pest Control Law, which allows the state to spray indiscriminately without notifying or gaining permission of individual landowners, the low-lying planes began to fly over the Detroit area. The city authorities and the Federal Aviation Agency were immediately besieged by calls from worried citizens. After receiving nearly 800 calls in a single hour, the police begged radio and television stations and newspapers to tell the watchers what they were seeing and advise them it was safe, according to the Detroit News. The Federal Aviation Agency's safety officer assured the public that the planes are carefully supervised and are authorized to fly low. In a somewhat mistaken attempt to allay fears, he added that the planes had emergency valves that would allow them to dump their entire load instantaneously. This fortunately was not done, but as the planes went about their work, the pellets of insecticide fell on beetles and humans alike. Showers of harmless poison descending on people shopping or going to work and on children out from school for the lunch hour. Housewives swept the granules from the porches and sidewalks where they are said to have looked like snow. As pointed out later by the Michigan Audubon Society, in the spaces between shingles on roofs, in eaves troughs, in the cracks in bark and twigs, the little white pellets of aldrin and clay, no bigger than a pinhead, were lodged by the millions. When the snow and rain came, every puddle became a possible death potion. Within a few days after the dusting operation, the Detroit Audubon Society began receiving calls about the birds. According to the Society's secretary, Mrs. Ann Boys, the first indication that the people were concerned about the spray was a call I received on Sunday morning from a woman who reported that coming home from church, she saw an alarming number of dead and dying birds. The spraying there had been done on Thursday. She said there were no birds at all flying in the area, and that she'd found at least a dozen dead in her backyard, and that the neighbors had found dead squirrels. All other calls received by Mrs. Boys that day reported a great many dead birds and no live ones. People who had maintained bird feeders said there were no birds at all at their feeders. Birds picked up in a dying condition showed the typical symptoms of insecticide poisoning: tremoring, loss of ability to fly, paralysis, convulsions. Nor were birds the only forms of life immediately affected. A local veterinarian reported that his office was full of clients with dogs and cats that had suddenly sickened. Cats who so meticulously groom their coats and lick their paws seemed to be most affected. Their illness took the form of severe diarrhea, vomiting, and convulsions. The only advice the veterinarian could give his clients was not to let the animals out unnecessarily, or to wash the paws promptly if they did so. But the chlorinated hydrocarbons cannot be washed, even from fruits or vegetables, so little protection could be expected from this measure. Despite the insistence of the city-county health commissioner that the birds must have been killed by some other kind of spraying, and that the outbreak of throat and chest irritations that followed the exposure to Aldrin must have been due to something else, the local health department received a constant stream of complaints. A prominent Detroit internist was called upon to treat four of his patients within an hour after they had been exposed while watching the planes at work. All had similar symptoms: nausea, vomiting, chills, fever, extreme fatigue, and coughing. The Detroit experience has been repeated in many other communities as pressure is mounted to combat the Japanese beetle with chemicals. At Blue Island, Illinois, hundreds of dead and dying birds were picked up. Data collected by birdbanders here suggests that 80% of the songbirds were sacrificed. In Joliet, Illinois, some 3,000 acres were treated with heptachlor in 1959. According to reports from a local sportsman's club, the bird population within the treated area was virtually wiped out. Dead rabbits, muskrats, opossums, and fish were also found in numbers, and one of the local schools made the collection of insecticide poison birds a science project. Perhaps no community has suffered more for the sake of a beetle-less world than Sheldon in eastern Illinois and adjacent areas in Iroquois County. In 1954, the United States Department of Agriculture and the Illinois Agriculture Department began a program to eradicate the Japanese beetle along the line of its advance into Illinois, holding out the hope, and indeed the assurance, that intensive spraying would destroy the populations of the invading insect. The first eradication took place that year when Dieldrin was applied to 1,400 acres by air. Another 2,600 acres were treated similarly in 1955, and the task was presumably considered complete. But more and more chemical treatments were called for, and by the end of 1961, some 131,000 acres had been covered. Even in the first years of the program, it was apparent that heavy losses were occurring among wildlife and domestic animals. The chemical treatments were continued, nevertheless, without consultation with either the United States Fish and Wildlife Service or the Illinois Game Management Division. In the spring of 1960, however, officials of the Federal Department of Agriculture appeared before a congressional committee in opposition to a bill that would require just such prior consultation. They declared blandly that the bill was unnecessary because cooperation and consultation were usual. These officials were quite unable to recall situations where cooperation had not taken place at the Washington level. In the same hearings, they stated clearly their unwillingness to consult with state fish and game departments. Although funds for chemical control came in never-ending streams, the biologists of the Illinois Natural History Survey who attempted to measure the damage to wildlife had to operate on a financial shoestring. A mere $1,100 was available for the employment of a field assistant in 1954, and no special funds were provided in 1955. Despite these crippling difficulties, the biologists assembled facts that collectively paint a picture of almost unparalleled wildlife destruction, destruction that became obvious as soon as the program got underway. Conditions were made to order for poisoning insect-eating birds, both in the poisons used and in the events set in motion by their application. In the early programs at Sheldon, Dieldrin was applied at the rate of 3 pounds to the acre. To understand its effect on birds, one need only remember that in laboratory experiments on quail, Dieldrin had proved to be about 50 times as poisonous as DDT. The poison spread over the landscape at Sheldon was therefore roughly equivalent to 150 pounds of DDT per acre. And this was a minimum because there seems to have been some overlapping of treatments along field borders and in corners. As the chemical penetrated the soil, the poisoned beetle grubs crawled out on the surface of the ground, where they remained for some time before they died, attractive to insect-eating birds. Dead and dying insects of various species were conspicuous for about 2 weeks after the treatment. The effect on the bird populations could easily have been foretold. Brown thrashers, starlings, meadowlarks, grackles, and pheasants were virtually wiped out. Robins were almost annihilated, according to the biologist's report. Dead earthworms had been seen in numbers after a gentle rain. Probably the robins had fed on the poisoned worms. For other birds, too, the once beneficial rain had been changed through the evil power of the poison introduced into their world into an agent of destruction. Birds seen drinking and bathing in puddles left by the rain a few days after the spraying were inevitably doomed. The birds that survived may have been rendered sterile, although a few nests were found in the treated area, a few with eggs. None contained young birds. Among the mammals, ground squirrels were virtually annihilated. Their bodies were found in attitudes characteristic of violent death by poisoning. Dead muskrats were found in the treated areas, dead rabbits in the fields. The fox squirrel had been a relatively common animal in the town. After the spraying, it was gone. It was a rare farm in the Sheldon area that was blessed by the presence of a cat after the war on beetles was begun. 90% of all the farm cats fell victims to the dieldrin during the first season of spraying. This might have been predicted because of the black record of these poisons in other places. Cats are extremely sensitive to all insecticides, and especially so, it seems, to dieldrin. In Western Java, in the course of the anti-malarial program carried out by the World Health Organization, many cats are reported to have died. In Central Java, so many were killed that the price of a cat more than doubled. Similarly, the World Health Organization spraying in Venezuela is reported to have reduced cats to the status of a rare animal. In Sheldon, it was not only the wild creatures and the domestic companions that were sacrificed in the campaign against an insect. Observations on several flocks of sheep and a herd of beef cattle are indicative of the poisoning and death that threatened livestock as well. The Natural History Survey report describes one of these episodes as follows. The sheep were driven into a small, untreated bluegrass pasture across a gravel road from a field which had been treated with dieldrin spray on May 6. Evidently, some spray had drifted across the road into the pasture, for the sheep began to show symptoms of intoxication almost at once. They lost interest in food and displayed extreme restlessness, following the pasture fence around and around, apparently searching for a way out. They refused to be driven, bleated almost continuously, and stood with their heads lowered. They were finally carried from the pasture. They displayed great desire for water. Two of the sheep were found dead in the stream passing through the pasture, and the remaining sheep were repeatedly driven out of the stream, several having to be dragged forcibly from the water. Three of the sheep eventually died. Those remaining recovered to all outward appearances. This, then, was the picture at the end of 1955. Although the chemical war went on in succeeding years, the trickle of research funds dried up completely. Requests for money for wildlife insecticide research were included in annual budgets submitted to the Illinois legislature by the Natural History Survey, but were invariably among the first items to be eliminated. It was not until 1960 that money was somehow found to pay the expenses of one field assistant to do the work that could easily have occupied the time of four men. The desolate picture of wildlife loss had changed little when the biologists resumed the studies broken off in 1955. In the meantime, the chemical had been changed to the even more toxic aldrin, 100 to 300 times as toxic as DDT in tests on quail. By 1960, every species of wild mammal known to inhabit the area had suffered losses. It was even worse with the birds. In the small town of Donovan, the robins had been wiped out, as had the grackles, starlings, and brown thrashers. These and many other birds were sharply reduced elsewhere. Pheasant hunters felt the effect of the beetle campaign sharply. The number of broods produced on treated lands fell off by some 50%, and the number of young in a brood declined. Pheasant hunting, which had been good in these areas in former years, was virtually abandoned as unrewarding. In spite of the enormous havoc that had been wrought in the name of eradicating the Japanese beetle, the treatment of more than 100,000 acres in Iroquois County over an 8-year period seems to have resulted in only temporary suppression of the insect, which continues its westward movement. The full extent of the toll that has been taken by this largely ineffective program may never be known, for the results measured by the Illinois biologists are a minimum figure. If the research program had been adequately financed to permit full coverage, the destruction revealed would have been even more appalling. But in the 8 years of the program, only about $6,000 was provided for biological field studies. Meanwhile, the federal government had spent about $375,000 for control work, and additional thousands had been provided by the state. The amount spent for research was therefore a small fraction of 1% of the outlay for the chemical program. These Midwestern programs have been conducted in a spirit of crisis, as though the advance of the beetle presented an extreme peril justifying any means to combat it. This, of course, is a distortion of the facts, and if the communities that have endured these chemical drenchings had been familiar with the earlier history of the Japanese beetle in the United States, they would surely have been less acquiescent. The eastern states, which had the good fortune to sustain their beetle invasion in the days before the synthetic insecticides had been invented, have not only survived the invasion, but have brought the insect under control by means that represented no threat whatever to other forms of life. There has been nothing comparable to the Detroit or Sheldon sprayings in the east. The effective methods there involved the bringing into play of natural forces of control, which have the multiple advantages of permanence and environmental safety. During the first dozen years after its entry into the United States, the beetle increased rapidly, free of the restraints that in its native land hold it in check. But by 1945, it had become a pest of only minor importance throughout much of the territory over which it had spread. Its decline was largely a consequence of the importation of parasitic insects from the Far East and of the establishment of disease organisms fatal to it. Between 1920 and 1933, as a result of diligent searching throughout the native range of the beetle, some 34 species of predatory or parasitic insects had been imported from the Orient in an effort to establish natural control. Of these, 5 became well established in the eastern United States. The most effective and widely distributed is a parasitic wasp from Korea and China, Typhia vernalis. The female Typhia, finding a beetle grub in the soil, injects a paralyzing fluid and attaches a single egg to the undersurface of the grub. The young wasp, hatching as a larva, feeds on the paralyzed grub and destroys it. In some 25 years, colonies of Typhia were introduced into 14 eastern states in a cooperative program of state and federal agencies. The wasp became widely established in this area and is generally credited by entomologists with an important role in bringing the beetle under control. An even more important role has been played by a bacterial disease that affects beetles of the family to which the Japanese beetle belongs, the scarabaeids. It is a highly specific organism, attacking no other type of insects, harmless to earthworms, warm-blooded animals, and plants. The spores of the disease occur in soil. When ingested by a foraging beetle grub, they multiply prodigiously in its blood, causing it to turn an abnormally white color, hence the popular name Milky disease. Milky disease was discovered in New Jersey in 1933. By 1938, it was rather widely prevalent in the older areas of Japanese beetle infestation. In 1939, a control program was launched directed at speeding up the spread of the disease. No method had been developed for growing the disease organism in an artificial medium, but a satisfactory substitute was evolved. Infected grubs are ground up, dried, and combined with chalk. In the standard mixture, a gram of dust contains 100 million spores. Between 1939 and 1953, some 94,000 acres in 14 eastern states were treated in a cooperative federal-state program. Other areas on federal lands were treated, and an unknown but extensive area was treated by private organizations or individuals. By 1945, milky spore disease was raging among the beetle populations of Connecticut, New York, New Jersey, Delaware, and Maryland. In some test areas, infection of grubs had reached as high as 94%. The distribution program was discontinued as a governmental enterprise in 1953, and production was taken over by a private laboratory, which continues to supply individuals, garden clubs, citizens' associations, and all others interested in beetle control. The eastern areas where this program was carried out now enjoy a high degree of natural protection from the beetle. The organism remains viable in the soil for years and therefore becomes, to all intents and purposes, permanently established, increasing in effectiveness and being continuously spread by natural agencies. Why, then, with this impressive record in the East, were the same procedures not tried in Illinois and other Midwestern states where the chemical battle of the beetles is now being waged with such fury? We are told that inoculation with milky spore disease is too expensive, although no one found it so in the 14 eastern states in the 1940s. And by what sort of accounting was the too expensive judgment reached? Certainly not by any that assessed the true costs of the total destruction wrought by such programs as the Sheldon spraying. This judgment also ignores the fact that inoculation with the spores need be done only once. The first cost is the only cost. We are told also that milky spore disease cannot be used on the periphery of the beetle's range because it can be established only where a large grub population is already present in the soil. Like many other statements in support of spraying, this one needs to be questioned. The bacterium that causes milky spore disease has been found to infect at least 40 other species of beetles, which collectively have quite a wide distribution and would in all probability serve to establish the disease even where the Japanese beetle population is very small or non-existent. Furthermore, because of the long viability of the spores in soil, they can be introduced even in the complete absence of grubs, as on the fringe of the present beetle infestation, there to await the advancing population. Those who want immediate results at whatever cost will doubtless continue to use chemicals against the beetle. So will those who favor the modern trend to built-in obsolescence, for chemical control is self-perpetuating, needing frequent and costly repetition. On the other hand, those who are willing to wait an extra season or two for full results will turn to milky disease. They will be rewarded with lasting control that becomes more rather than less effective with the passage of time. An extensive program of research is underway in the United States Department of Agriculture Laboratory at Peoria, Illinois, to find a way to culture the organism of milky disease on an artificial medium. This will greatly reduce its cost and should encourage its more extensive use. After years of work, some success has now been reported. When this breakthrough is thoroughly established, perhaps some sanity and perspective will be restored to our dealings with the Japanese beetle, which at the peak of its depredations never justified the nightmare excesses of some of these Midwestern programs. Incidents like the Eastern Illinois spraying raise a question that is not only scientific, but moral. The question is whether any civilization can wage relentless war on life without destroying itself and without losing the right to be called civilized. These insecticides are not selective poisons. They do not single out the one species of which we desire to be rid. Each of them is used for the simple reason that it is a deadly poison. It therefore poisons all life with which it comes in contact. The cat beloved of some family, the farmer's cattle, the rabbit in the field, and the horned lark out of the sky. These creatures are innocent of any harm to man. Indeed, by their very existence, they and their fellows make his life more pleasant. Yet he rewards them with a death that is not only sudden, but horrible. Scientific observers at Sheldon described the symptoms of a meadowlark found near death. Although it lacked muscular coordination and could not fly or stand, it continued to beat its wings and clutch with its toes while lying on its side. Its beak was held open and breathing was labored. Even more pitiful was the mute testimony of the dead ground squirrels, which exhibited a characteristic attitude in death. The back was bowed and the forelegs with the toes of the feet tightly clenched were drawn close to the thorax. The head and neck were outstretched, and the mouth often contained dirt, suggesting that the dying animal had been biting at the ground. By acquiescing in an act that can cause such suffering to a living creature, who among us is not diminished as a human being?
This ends Disc 3.